This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The White Sox haven't made the series once since 59. They haven't won since back in 17, and so it's fine that they are there. And meanwhile, Houston's never made the trip beyond the playoffs, so both clubs have got to get a grip on circumstances far beyond what they're accustomed to. In baseball's brightest spotlight, will they each know what to do? Joining me now from Chicago with reassurance that two teams utterly unfamiliar with the World Series will show up to play tonight is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. This is the first trip to the World Series in 44 years for the Houston Astros since the team began, and the Chicago White Sox first Fall Classic appearance since 59, as I said. How can anybody choose a sentimental favorite between these two teams?
You can't, Bill. There's too much karma going for both teams. We're all rooting for both teams, and I don't see how that's going to happen, that both teams are going to win. But it would only be fitting if they did. And in this unbelievably unpredictable season in baseball, in which, by the way, I got everything wrong this time.
Yay!
I had no idea that these teams were going to end up in the World Series, not at the beginning of the year. And halfway through the year, I didn't see any way the Astros could even make it to the playoffs. But as we talk about all the time, this is the ultimate beauty of the game, is it pops up and surprises us all the time.
The style of play in last year's World Series could perhaps be described as Hulk smash. Both the Red Sox and the Cardinals had lots of power hitters. The White Sox and the Astros excel at bunting, base stealing, defense. Are you happy to see a change in style from last year's affair?
Well, I am, Bill, and it's not just from last year. It's from really the last 10 years in baseball. We have been through one of the great offensive explosions of all time over the last 10 years. And now it appears, for whatever reason, we are back to bunting the ball, moving the ball around. I just covered the Cardinals and the Astros, and no team in that six-game series scored more than 5 runs in any game. Mm-hmm. And that really tells you something about where that series went. And it tells me that, you know, these teams are not really good hitting teams. I mean, the White Sox do not have a 300 hitter in their lineup. It's been over 20 years since a team had the best record in its league without a 300 hitter. And I'm telling you, Bill, you look at the Astros certain days, as Phil Garner said, I don't know how we ever got here with the way that we swing the bats. They were shut out 17 times this year. The only other team in history to get to the postseason having been shut out that many times was the 1966 Dodgers, and that was, of course, a completely different era and a different style of play now. But we're kind of back to that, where we're going to see bunts in the first inning of this series, we're going to see stolen bases, we're going to see squeeze bunts, and I say hooray.
One thing that both these teams do have is pitching, and we don't even know how good their relief pitching is because their starters are so good they don't need their relievers and their closers. When was the last time you saw pitching like this on two teams headed into the World Series?
I can't remember the last time that I saw starting staffs quite like this. For the Astros, for instance, there's never been 3 consecutive starting pitchers in postseason history like the 3 the Astros have. That is, this many decisions each and a .650 career winning percentage each. Never in the history of the postseason. Then you get the White Sox, who have terrific starting pitching all season, and they are the first team since 1928, when the Yankees did it, to have 4 consecutive complete game victories in the postseason. I mean, so we're talking about some serious history here, and that's the ultimate reason why these scores could easily be 2-1 and 3-2. And again, I maintain sometimes those are the best games because it's a little thing in a game that decides who wins, not necessarily who hits a 600-foot home run.
Of the 4 pitchers who will be starting this weekend for the White Sox and the Astros, 3 are former Yankees. What are the odds that George Steinbrenner is throwing furniture around the Yankee compound in Tampa even as we speak?
Well, I'm sure he's already wrecked the place. And he will wreck it more when Roger Clemens, one of his guys, will start Game 1 of the World Series for the Astros, and Andy Pettit will start Game 2, another Yankee. It's so odd to me that the Yankees' problem all season was their pitching just wasn't good enough, and half the pitchers in the major leagues used to pitch for the Yankees. It just goes to show you the cliche is always true. If you can pitch, you have a chance, and that's why these two teams are in the World Series, period.
Tim, obviously last year the storyline throughout the playoffs was, can the Red Sox finally win? There are so many subplots this year. Have you a favorite among them?
to me, the best subplot of this World Series is that Jeff Bagwell and Craig Biggio are going to the World Series. They have played nearly 4,800 combined games without getting here. One guy played for 18 years. The other guy's played for 15 years. And they played 15 years together on the right side of the infield. And believe me, Bill, in every way, they are the right side of the infield because the way they played the game, they played it correctly. And I know people, baseball players all across the country who are applauding the fact that finally these two guys who've done it right for so long are going to the World Series. And the interesting point is that it's possible Jeff Bagwell, who has a bad shoulder and can't throw, might end up being the DH here in Chicago, and that would be a great thing because he's a Hall of Fame player right now, and he deserves to play a little bit more than just being a pinch hitter in the postseason.
Of course, in the other dugout, you got Frank Thomas finally getting to the World Series, albeit unhappily only as a spectator.
Well, that's the only sad part for me about this, Bill, because as you may know, Jeff Bagwell and Frank Thomas won the MVP in the same year. They play the same position, and get this, they were born on the exact same day. So, and to be, to me, both Hall of Famers who played the same position, and with all these coincidences, they should be rival DHs hitting fourth for their teams in this postseason or in this World Series. And sadly, that's not going to happen, but there's a lot of other good things going on here.
Finally, Tim, your characterization of yourself as predictor extraordinaire, notwithstanding, it's time for you to tell me which team will continue its long postseason nightmare.
Well, first off, I got them all right in the postseason last year.
There you go.
I'm not the worst ever, although I'm close. This year, I've got them just about all of them wrong. I had the Cardinals beating the Yankees in the World Series this year. So, having said that, I am going to say that the Astros are going to win this series. And I'm going to base that mostly on the history part of this, the starting pitching part of this. And I've just seen them for the last 2 weeks. And there's something special going on there, Bill. I believe in karma. I believe in all that stuff. And I've seen them win some games where I scratched my head and said, how'd they win that game? Well, when that happens enough times, my father always told me, something interesting is going on when those things repeatedly happen. They have for the Astros. The problem is they keep happening for the White Sox, too. So it's really tricky, but I'll take the Astros, and I say they win in seven.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thank you very much. Enjoy the games.
Okay, Bill, thanks.
Though the north side of Chicago currently mourns another lost season for their beloved Cubs, the south side rejoices. That's especially true for the historic Bridgeport neighborhood, where voting Democrat and rooting for the White Sox are staples of local culture. Schaller's Pump, a Bridgeport bar that sits across the street from the local Democratic headquarters and mere blocks from the old Comiskey Park and the relatively new U.S. Cellular Field, is often the epicenter of both aforementioned causes. Producer Jesse Hardman caught up with a few Schaller's regulars as the White Sox played the Anaheim Angels in Game 2 of the American League Championship Series, and he presents this audio portrait.
Joey Crow, we're at Schaller's Pump. I work for the city of Chicago, this great city that we have here. Bridgeport's a great neighborhood just west of Comiskey Park. Some people call it the Cell, U.S. Cellular Field, but it's still called Comiskey here in Bridgeport. I grew up in the neighborhood here, and you had two teams to root for. You had to root for the Sox and whoever played the Cubs, so you had no choice.
My name is Karen Bertucci. I am from Bridgeport, and I am at Schaller's Pub.
And tell me how you came to be a Sox fan.
Well, when you're born in Bridgeport, you don't have a choice. You're kind of born into it. It's just something that you just grow up doing. I don't know. I never even knew that there was another Chicago team. When I got in high school and someone said something about the Chicago Cubs, I thought, well, who are they? They actually play baseball? 0-2, two outs. Bottom of the fifth, bases loaded. We're tied score here. We need a hit. We'll settle for an oh. And he struck out. Nothing like choking. Come on, guys.
My name is Jay Schaller. You're at Schaller's Pump right now watching the American League Championship Series. The restaurant you're in now has been in my family for over 120 years. I'm the fourth generation to work here. I started here in about 1983. So that'd be about 22 years I've been here. I have a great time. A lot of nice people I've met over the years. A lot of great Sox fans, seen a lot of great games.
What makes it the place it is?
Oh, it's just old-time tavern. It looks like it's 120 years old. But it's got good character. You know, wood panel walls all around. Peepholes, you can find them. Used to be a speakeasy back in Prohibition times, and we had a couple of doors in the building that have peepholes in them, so you'd know who you were letting in or not letting in. And they're still here.
What have you noticed people drinking as the Sox have progressively gotten closer to the World Series?
Whatever it is they drink a lot more here now that the Sox are winning.
My name is Carol. I live right here in Bridgeport, and my history is I've been going to Sox fans since I was old enough to walk. I love the hustle and bustle and the craziness, how the neighborhood comes alive during Sox season. Yeah, the parking's a hassle, but that's okay.
And can you describe where we are right now and what it looks like and why it's a part of the Sox?
It's the old watering hole for the Democratic Party, which is right across the street. The old Mayor Daley and Mayor Blandick always hung out in here. Every election was celebrated in here, every victory. I was here for many of those. It's just a place, it's like our little Cheers. Everybody knows everybody, and it's a comfortable place to come.
What's the pregame routine? What do you eat and drink? And
grilled ham and cheese every game, and Jack Daniels on the rocks.
Every game is in the whole season?
No. Oh, my God. Just playoffs.
That's a lot of ham and cheese and Jack Daniels.
It sure is. But they have great ham and cheese here, and that this bar, Schaller's, is Bridgeport.
Yes!
Producer Jesse Hardman at Schaller's Pump, a gathering place for White Sox fans in Chicago's Bridgeport neighborhood.
So now what's happening here?
Now I gotta play We Are the Champions. I can't find it. Man, oh man, my one job, I'm gonna blow it. Come on.
It's night. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Katarina Witt will spin the tale of her career in ice skating. But first, on October 11th, more than 28% of Liberian voters cast their ballots for former international soccer star George Weah. While this made him the top finisher among 22 presidential candidates, it was far below the 50.1% needed to send him to the executive mansion. Instead, Weah and second-place finisher Ellen Johnson Sirleaf will face off in a head-to-head race on November 9th. Weah's move from the pitch to the polls has galvanized Liberian youth, who turn out by the thousands anytime King George appears in public. It has also helped accent a deep social divide that splits this very troubled land. Only a Game's Ken Shulman visited Liberia and filed this report.
These are the youth of Liberia. Their candidate is George Weah, former international soccer star and now front runner in the country's presidential race. It's Saturday morning and the elections are 3 days away. Draped in T-shirts, hoisting placards with his likeness, Weah's supporters flood the streets of Monrovia, surging towards party headquarters for the largest political rally of the campaign. He no book, why are people suffering? Weah's young minions chant. He no book, why are people dying? The chant is a rebuke to the traditional political elite, to the educated, literate class that no book, and nonetheless has led Liberia through decades of misrule, abuse, and devastating civil war. What good is education, they ask provocatively, if it only leads to ruin?
We started as young people of the country. We thought that the old politicians have failed the country. We thought that the only good thing they brought to this country was to organize wars. They didn't use their education, we just consider them as educated fools.
Claude Cattagino is an accountant and a founding member of the Congress for Democratic Change, George Weah's political party. The CDC is a broad-based populist movement that capitalizes on the extreme disenchantment and equally extreme idealism prevalent among Liberian youth. Weah, a self-made man and international soccer star, a former World Football Player of the Year, and, more recently, UNICEF's Goodwill Ambassador to Africa, is both CDC symbol and standard bearer. For Cattagino and his fellow CDC founders, the choice of candidate was clear.
We have 22 candidates in this country, and we don't trust any one of them. First and foremost, ambassadors. Weah is a typical grassrooter. He understands poverty. He came from poverty. He knows what it feels and what it means, you know, for the typical Liberian, how they feel, what the typical Liberian, you know, experiencing. So we all govern as again, ambassador Weah, because first and foremost, we trust him. It's just a matter of trust. We trust him.
Turn up in mass on October 11 to wisely choose our future leaders and change the course of our history towards a more prosperous, peaceful, and democratic Liberia. I thank you.
Founded by freed American slaves in the early 19th century, Liberia was ruled by a small, corrupt elite for over 100 years. After a military takeover in 1980, Liberia spiraled through a series of civil wars that fragmented the country, took hundreds of thousands of lives, and sent nearly half the country's 3.5 million inhabitants into exile. Once known as the jewel of West Africa, Liberia degenerated into a criminalized state known only for the lurid images of sadistic warlords and hapless child soldiers that war correspondents beamed to audiences back home.
We were engaged in a massive civil war. There were massive human rights abuses. I mean, some of us were embarrassed to be called Liberians. Those are, we are brutal people. We are savages. We're just killing each other. We are wearing wigs.
Ezekiel Pajibo is a civil society activist based in Monrovia. He recently returned to Liberia after years of exile in the United States.
And all of a sudden, from that kind of mix, emerged the number one football player in the world. You know, and now it's just for Liberia, the world, and Africa celebrate George Weah, the world celebrate George Weah. So from a country that was destroyed came an individual who, like, was on top of the world. So we honor him, he made us feel good, we could lift up our heads, and we could be proud that something good can come out of us.
George Mane Weah was born in 1966 in the Monrovia slum of Claretown. At age 16, he left high school to work as a switchboard operator. At age 17, he left the country to play professional soccer in Cameroon, where he became known as Opong. Weah's talent and hard work carried him to stardom in France, Italy, and England. On the field, George Weah moved with a feline grace, reading bounces and caroms as if he'd seen the plays the night before.
And I will say to you, I am your son.
Yes.
I say to you, I say, listen, vote for me because I know you.
Yes.
Vote for me because you know me. Vote for me because I love you and I love this country.
Weah's performance in the political arena has been more fitful. He's uncertain in public speech, seems hamstrung in crowds, as if still struggling to learn his position. Nonetheless, the crowd still loves him.
For all the other people who got away from me, you know, and women power. Yeah? Women power. And it's time for us too.
With the majority of Liberia illiterate, political campaigns are waged with caravans and loudspeakers. Candidates spend hours and sometimes days in jeeps, churning through roads pounded into mud by July and August rains. Weah's opponent in the November 9th presidential runoff is Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. A Harvard-trained economist and a former official at the World Bank, Johnson Sirleaf ran unsuccessfully for president against warlord Charles Taylor in 1997. She and Weah are polar opposites. She is erudite, experienced, and nearly 30 years his senior. While Johnson Sirleaf admires Weah, she doesn't think a political novice, and particularly a high school dropout, is fit to lead the nation.
What do we need at this critical time in our nation's history to be able to fix this economy, to be able to take those hard decisions that turn this country around, put it on a democratic track? And so anyone who leads the nation must understand the issues, they must understand the enormity of the problem we face, and they must be able to grapple with it based upon experience. It's not enough to just surround yourself with people. If you don't have that self-confidence and that capacity, chances are people around you are going to be, you know, flunkies and failures, and they will try to lead you.
Monrovia is a noisy city. Portable sidewalk generators and wheelbarrow-borne stereos grind out a gritty chorus. Dilapidated cars teeter on the edges of lunar-sized craters, while dormant streetlights droop mournfully on slouching posts. And this is the capital. Conditions in the provinces are far worse. The country George Weah hopes to rule has no infrastructure, no roads, and no economy. Its democratic institutions are weak or non-existent. 85% of its people are unemployed. The same percentage lives in poverty. It is $3.5 billion in debt. While Weah has always placed a premium on education, he personally funds the studies of over 300 students at Liberian universities. His campaign has unwittingly become a magnet for the marginalized, the uneducated, and the illiterate who compose so much of Liberia's electorate.
The 85% of the youth are not educated. So because they are not educated, they are unable to distinguish between the good and the bad. So they don't even want to know whether George Weah can deliver or not. All they know, he plays football.
B. Jabote is a 28-year-old businessman. Like so many of his generation, his university studies were interrupted by the war. He worries that the CDC has become, despite Weah's efforts, a celebration of ignorance. He also worries about the message a Weah presidency might send to the world.
Already, Liberia is indebted to the international worth $3.5 billion. What are you going to tell them? What are you going to tell the donors? What are you going to tell the international community, the UN? What are you going to tell them to help us? Because Liberia can't pay that money right now. Are you going to present football to them, ask them to go on the football field to play with you? No. You got to come up with an economic reform program that's going to convince them that even if they drop the debt, you'll be able to come up with something better. If they can't see that trust and confidence in you and your government, I'm sorry. Nobody's going to come here with fasting.
There are other threats to Liberian stability. One of these are ex-combatants who still control key resources about the country. These former rebels occupy the Guthrie rubber plantation just outside Monrovia. In a tacit agreement, the United Nations and Liberia's interim government allow them to tap and sell rubber so long as they observe the peace. Seko Fofana is their leader, and he's still angry.
If you check the bush here, we are more than 15,000 men that are in the bush here surviving from this Guthrie. If you have not been in this Guthrie, nobody will sleep inside Monrovia there. Then when the later government sit down and they don't look after us again, we'll move them from the different government, we'll sit down there.
How will you remove them? By force if necessary?
We will remove them by persuaded leadership through how we meet only our men in the bush, because these men are still under our control.
It's Sunday morning, 2 days before Tuesday's elections, on the last day of the campaign. George Weah has come to pray at the Methodist Church in Monrovia's waterside, site of some of the capital's bloodiest battles during the recent war. With his wife, far from the glare of television lights, the former soccer star bends his head. After the service, he said that he'd asked God to make him a true leader, one who will act in the people's interest. Today, the scripture reading is from the book of Exodus. It's a fitting choice. There are hand-painted posters all across Liberia depicting Weah dressed as Moses, as the prophet who will redeem them from decades of bondage, poverty, and misrule. It's a tall order for any leader, especially one who has never held public office. Yet in his meetings with the ex-combatants in 2004, the man who was still slow of speech managed to find the right words.
And when I spoke to them to disarm, they were willing to disarm. And the only thing I said to them to disarm, for the country to be stable, for them to be peaceful. Because if they don't disarm, they're going to go back to war. Not the politician, because we're going to jump on the next flight to go and wait. After they finish killing each other, then we'll come back. Then we'll come to rule them.
This has been a difficult campaign for Weah. His once compact entourage has swelled with opportunists, hangers-on, with officials from previous regimes hoping to profit from his inexperience and return to power. He's had to make painful compromises to secure allies. Most of all, he suffered, almost as a personal affront, each time his opponents target his lack of education. Yet here, too, at campaign's end, Weah was finally able to respond to his critics.
A politician was telling my supporters that I was not capable, I can't read and write, I can't even speak English. But I went back to my people and let them know that speaking English is not an issue. Reading is not an issue. The issue got to do with the life and survival of our people. Why you don't have food is the issue. Why you don't have roads, these are the issues. Why you don't have light, these are the issues. Because everybody that can speak English, they are govern your country, but yet and stay, you have nothing.
This is for the president, the red, the blue, for the what? The senator, the green, for the representative. Huh? Thank you. God bless you. Go in peace. Thank you.
There is some precedent for political amateurs seeking public office in other lands, and even in the U.S. A professional wrestler has governed Minnesota. One-time quarterbacks and wide receivers hook up for gains in the House of Representatives. And the man who played Notre Dame running back George Gipp in Newt Rockne All-American served two terms in the White House. But there is room for amateurs in America, a land with strong democratic institutions, with functioning schools, with roads and utilities and rule of law, with voters who don't need color codes or party symbols to identify their candidates on the ballot, and politicians who are usually held accountable for their crimes. It's different in Liberia, because whichever candidate wins on November 9th will not merely have to steer the Liberian ship of state. He or she will have to build it. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Monrovia, Liberia.
You're listening to Only a Game. For the last few days, ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages have been carving pumpkins on the Boston Common. The ongoing festival of gourd slicing is sponsored by the Life is Good Clothing Company, which, according to Bert Jacobs, who calls himself the chief executive optimist at Life is Good, has Guinness Book of World Record aspirations. When I visited the Common earlier this week, I asked Mr. Jacobs exactly what record they were trying to break.
The most lit jack-o'-lanterns in one place at one time, and that current record is 28,000 and some change, held by Keene, New Hampshire.
Yeah, but if it's 28,000 and some, how are you going to know if you broke it?
Oh, we'll know. By Saturday, we'll get our facts straight.
Concern with facts and record-breaking seemed to be coming a distant second to fun when I was on the Common, although lots of the carvers were counting.
What'd they do? 32 pumpkins.
The three of you did 32 pumpkins?
Yep.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And it's going to take you, what, no more than a week to get your hands clean, right?
Right. Yeah, maybe a couple of years.
The real point of all this pumpkin carving is to raise money for and awareness of Camp Sunshine, a lakeside summer vacation program in Casco, Maine, built to accommodate families that include a child suffering from a potentially terminal illness. But that doesn't mean a fundraiser can't also serve as an educational vehicle, especially if you've wandered onto the Boston Common out of a culture that doesn't include Halloween. This was the case with a young Italian woman named Marta.
We are Italian, so we don't have this tradition of Halloween and the pumpkins, so it's the first time that they're actually carving pumpkins in their life. Allegri is 6 and Federico is 4. Oh, Federico, look, we have a first high. Shall we do another one?
Yeah.
Okay, where shall we do it? What do you think?
The real pros planned less than Marta and her children did, and they carved more. By late Wednesday afternoon, there were already too many jack-o'-lanterns for me to count. Happily, there were two accountants on hand to take care of that chore, and I was told the installation of a score gourd would occur soon. Lots of the pumpkins have been or are being carved at other locations in and around Boston. By this evening, they'll all have arrived at the Common, where they will be arranged and lit in glimmering rows on a score of scaffolds. But that spectacle is still some hours off, and among those with their eyes on a record, there's still a lot of carving to be done.
I love that part. I'm taking off my ring.
Scoop it out.
You gotta get all the guts out.
Feel it?
Get all the guts out. We got
it's gushy.
Just think if we went to a haunted house, we'd feel it, and we'd say, ooh, these are is... What is that? What do I feel? Think these feel like guts?
Here, watch this, Lily. See how you go like this and scrape around?
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot Cheese.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation about passion with figure skater turned author Katarina Witt. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The World Series begins tonight. I hope you're a fan of low-scoring games.
Yes, Bill, I'm a fan of any games I'm not going to watch. No, that's not true. I will watch.
I will watch
the World Series. I'm a fan of these two teams. I mean, if baseball was looking for an antidote to the steroid muscle pumping home run bashes of yore, they've got it.
Absolutely.
You've got the Chicago White Sox, who put up four complete games, an unheard of thing in the ALCS, which means that their closer, this Bobby Jenks guy, is probably going to throw the ball 200 miles an hour when he finally makes it to the mound. And with the Astros, you've got great starting pitchers, including Roy Oswalt, who I didn't realize is as good as he is, and, of course, Roger Clemens in another World Series.
And, of course, a battle between two teams for whom a World Series will be an absolute foreign object.
Yes, and we can all hope, I think, that this time the White Sox will play it straight. Because say it ain't so, Pasednik just doesn't track. Play fair, Chicago!
This week, Victor Conti was sentenced to 4 months in prison and 4 months home confinement for the distribution of steroids. Is the book now closed on all matters, Balco?
Gee, the steroid crisis is really a threat to the society in which we live, Bill. The guy at the center of it gets 4 months in jail and 4 months at home. This does not strike me after, 4 or 5 years of superheated national debate like we busted the Gambino family.
Last week, we spoke briefly of the proposed NBA dress code, Charlie. Now we know what the dress code is, and we know how lots of players feel about it. Any chance Mr. Commissioner will slap his forehead and say, "Oh, what a mistake I've made. Forgive me. I take it all back."
No, there isn't, but it's a stupid idea. It was a stupid idea when they thought of it. It opens the league up to all sorts of problems with its most tangible assets, namely its most visible face, which is the players. It is, quite frankly, a sop to soothe the fears of scared white suburban people who buy tickets and who buy the jerseys and who come to the games and, coincidentally, whose children dress very much like NBA players used to dress, and they're nervous about it. This is a crisis that did not have to happen. There will be some sort of up-and-down, outright rebellion through the entire season. The league will get not a black eye this time, but it'll just look stupid.
Charlie, is it safe to say that Eric James Torpy has established an unshakable claim that he is Larry Bird's greatest fan?
Yeah, he was sentenced to a 30-year term for assault with intent to kill. He said he wanted the prison term to go 3 more years so it would match Larry Bird's jersey number, 33. Nobody complained. Certainly DA doesn't have any problem with the guy doing more time. But couldn't the guy have said he was like a Doug Flutie fan?
Yeah, good point. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin has a lot to worry about these days. You wouldn't think the fate of the New Orleans Saints would be so high on his list, would you?
Well, I mean, it is a big deal. They're talking about, Tom Benson is talking about working with the San Antonio people to keep the team in Texas. It would be a big measure of corporate abandonment of New Orleans if the Saints were to up and leave. I would expect that the NFL would step in here and realize what a public relations disaster this would be, and I don't imagine it much wants a team in San Antonio at this point.
A hurricane is again wreaking havoc in football and elsewhere. Wilma is on her way to Florida, creating a postponement in college football and a Friday night NFL game. The Chiefs and Dolphins played last night, much to the delight of Friday night football fans.
Yeah, and of course, the great thing was that all the carefully laid plans of genuine football gibberish, beloved of NFL coaches, had to get moved up 2 days. Oh, no, we can't have the 15th film session. How will we handle their dime package? Well, you know what? You'll draw it up in the dirt, maybe.
Brett Hull decided this week that the hockey season is too long. By about 6 months, he retired. Are you surprised?
Yeah, I am, because he had been outspoken for years about the way the game had degenerated into clutch and grab and look forward to the new rules. But I guess when they opened up the game and it required speed, he didn't have it anymore. But he will, I guarantee you, become an instant presence on SportsCenter telecast near you.
More intrigue on the race car circuit this week, Charlie, this time involving the Indy Racing League rather than the NASCAR with which you are so familiar. Did Danica Patrick slug Jacques Lazier or just tap him lightly on the head to make a point about his careless driving?
I don't know. They wrangled. They tangled up and bumped up and wrecked on the track, and they put him in the same ambulance, and she came out with a sore elbow. I'd like to know, get the testimony of the paramedics on this one.
This is sounding a little like WWE. Subplots on the track. And finally, Charlie, golf etiquette says that a slower player should step aside and let faster golfers play through. Is that what Mr. Raymond Yee was thinking on a course in Orange County, California earlier this week?
Yes, Raymond Yee, an Orange County Sheriff's deputy, has to go to trial because he pulled a gun on two slow-playing golfers. First of all, there are certain places, because of the nature of the people there, where, where firearms should not be allowed. Prisons, elementary schools, and golf courses.
Yes.
The problem with it, of course, is escalation. If you arm one golfer, you have to arm them all, or else it's no fun.
Charlie Pierce plays through this part of Only a Game each week. He brandishes a mean 9-iron, but never a mean 9mm on the links. He writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
There's a murder going on. The boys are talking fast. Oh, woe is me. There's a murder going on. Who will it be? Whose head will roll down the course? I don't know about Ralph. Can he handle me? Warehouse by himself. Looks shaky to me. But what about his cute kids and his wife? What'll they do without his life?
In order to tell the story of her career and her life, in a new book entitled Only with Passion, figure skating champion Katarina Witt enlisted the assistance of Sports Illustrated senior writer E.M. Swift. Together, they decided to insert into the storytelling process a semi-fictional 16-year-old figure skater who would visit Katarina Witt at her home in Berlin and seek advice about her career and her life choices. The result of the two- or three-way collaboration is unusual and engrossing. Two-time Olympic gold medalist and former world champion Katarina Witt joins me now from New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Yes, hello.
You grew up in the German Democratic Republic, and you write in the book that if you hadn't grown up there, you wouldn't have become a figure skater. Why is that?
Well, I think just everything by coincidence. I mean, that I was born there, and then my kindergarten was close to the ice rink. I watched it, and I loved it, and I fell in love with it, and I was begging my parents to take me skating and become a figure skater. And then, of course, Frau Müller, who is one of the most successful coaches in figure skating, who I happened to meet there, and she happened to see that I have talent, and she took me under her wings, and living in East Germany, how the sports system was supported helped. Mm. That is definitely true.
You were 9 years old when Frau Müller chose you as a pupil, somebody to work with her, and you write that sometimes you had to hate her in order to progress as a champion. Is that a coach-athlete relationship that you would endorse today?
Well, definitely we had a love-hating relationship, I would call it, because I very much respected her and admired her, and I knew the minute she took me and she chose me as an athlete, I knew, wow, she sees talent and I could be a really, really good skater, because I knew she had already European champion and world champions. And I know she was tough. The first minute I saw her, I know she was a very, very tough and strong coach, and I knew what I was getting into. She was strong. She would, on the ice, be very tough with me. But after the hour of skating, she would come back to the dressing room and say, look, you know, you really can make it. And I trusted her. And I think a coach can't really be your friend. Your coach has to push you over the limit. And it doesn't work when he hugs you and goes, oh, no, it's going to be okay. We'll do tomorrow or the next day. In sports, every minute you lose, you could miss it at the end by the worlds, that you miss that second of stamina or whatever it is. And for that, of course, then I loved her, because she helped and supported me in what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a champion one day.
You and Ed Swift created a composite of young skaters and named the composite character Jasmine. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to tell your story to this audience of one, this fictitious character?
Well, the thing is that I didn't want to just write a biography. I mean, everything what's in the book, it's what I have experienced, and I wanted to tell this experience to teenagers, to young athletes, or to it could be a musician, it could be a dancer, anybody who has a passion for something they want to do. And here with Jasmine, she has for the very first time a serious relationship, and she really wants to go for it, but she is this talented skater, and her coach and her mom, they don't know what to do anymore. So I think with this, it got a little more of a storyline, and I feel there are moments which are really warm, and I really like Jasmine, and I wanted to help her, but I never tell her really what to do. I just let her take part of what I do now. You know, I would take her skating, and she gets to meet Fran Müller, my coach. She's able to talk to her. I take her to my favorite restaurant in Berlin, and she sees how it is once you're successful and you get your table, and I tell her the story how it is to meet celebrities there. And then, of course, you know, we sit in the kitchen and we go through the scrapbooks. I show her the Olympics, and I can see the spark in her eye, and I can just tell, God, she wants to be there maybe one day. And I just try to tell her what I've been through, and explaining her by my story.
It sounds as if now that the book is finished, perhaps you miss her.
I do. I don't have anybody to talk to anymore. Yeah, you know, it could be, her name could be anybody who is out there who has a talent for something. And it was just really nice to have her as an imagination, but at the end to sort of, no, she could be real. She is just anywhere out there.
It may surprise some fans of your sport to learn that even as a champion, before competitions, you would sometimes pray as follows, and I'm quoting now, God, please, please, if you exist, let me win. I'll go to church then, I promise. Was that a more important ritual than making sure the stuffed animals were all lined up in the right order?
It was all part of it, you know. I mean, I would always do this. And then, believe it or not, I, of course, would never go to church. I mean, how bad of me. And then the next time before a competition, I would remember and I would go, okay, this time, please help me, let me win. I'll promise I'll come, and I burn a candle. And then, of course, I win, and all my promises were forgotten. It was some kind of a superstitious thing.
At another point in the book, you tell Jasmine that your country can use you as a political tool, and when you lose, they make you feel like you've let everyone down. Is there a part of you that's kind of happy to be beyond that stage of your life?
I think it's with, like, a lot of things. If you win, all of a sudden, they all participated in it, you know. And if you lose, nobody wants to have anything to do with you. So, of course, in the time I grew up, sports was very much used for political things, you know. There was the Cold War going on, and it was even in the media very much made up, you know, like the Battle of the Two Carmens. So me from East Germany, from a communist country, from not a free country, and there is Debbie, who is from America. So it was all used, and of course we all sort of participated in it. And of course, you know, a country is proud of their athletes. It's the same when you're up there on the podium, you hear your national anthem, and you feel pride.
You may ultimately be as well remembered for your performance at the 1994 Olympics in Lillehammer, where you skated to Where Have All the Flowers Gone, as you will be for the two gold medal winning performances in 84 and 88. And yet you write in the book that even now you feel as if you failed at the 94 Games. Why?
Oh, you're putting the finger on a very sensitive spot. You really read the book, huh? How wonderful.
I did.
Thank you. Well, the thing was that going into those Olympics, they had so many meanings to me. First of all, it was for the very first time my parents were part of it, because me being in East Germany while I was an amateur skater, they were never allowed to travel with me. So to share that with me was so important for me that I invited them. We had a whole house rented. I had my brother, my whole family and friends, and I wanted for them to celebrate this with me. And then, of course, I wanted to perform and show the program Where Have All the Flowers Gone as a tribute to Sarajevo, because my first Olympics I won in Sarajevo in 84. And it's been so terribly destroyed by the war that I felt I wanted to use that stage to never forget what a beautiful town that was and what wonderful Olympics it was and how it is when athletes from all over the world come together in peace. And then I was really well prepared, and I go out for this competition for the Olympics, and my short program goes really, really well. And then all of a sudden, I'm skating last in the last group of the ladies. And it was always something I loved to do when I was an amateur. And here, it was 6 years later, and I probably missed some experience of real pressure. And all of a sudden, my athlete's heart kicks in, where I think, oh my God, I have a chance. I maybe even could medal and be on the podium. And it was actually really stupid of me. But at the end, the Olympics is the Olympics, and it's about being an athlete. And of course, I wanted to show the program, and I did show the program, and people really loved it. But I did mistakes in the program I hardly did before, and I was just very, very sad because I felt I failed. I felt I didn't deliver what I wanted to deliver. So at the very end, you see, I'm saying I'm sorry to the audience, and it was really, really hard for me, but I got a standing ovation. And the nice thing is people don't remember the mistakes. They remember that I skated Where Have All the Flowers Gone and what the meaning for me was for the Olympics. So that's, you know, what stays in their memory and which helps me getting over my sadness that I felt I didn't really deliver what I wanted to.
Katarina Witt with E.M. Swift wrote Only with Passion, Figure Skating's Most Winning Champion on Competition and Life, published by Public Affairs. She joined me from New York. Katarina, this was great fun. Thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much.
Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Wo sind sie geblieben? Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Ist geschehen. Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Mädchen pflückten sie geschwind. Wann wird man je verstehen? Wann wird man je verstehen?
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from the Mermen and Mermaids at Splash Studios. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Ken Shulman's photos of the recent Liberian presidential elections, learn more about Katarina Witt's literary ambitions, browse Only a Game's show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the world's greatest figure skater and preeminent writer, Katarina Witt.
Little Field, that's such a cute name.
I felt it necessary to tell Ms. Witt there's a time for flirting and a time for serious interviewing.
Little Field. I'm sorry.
How do you say cold shower in German? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Mädchen pflückten sie geschwind. Wann wird man je verstehen? Wann wird man je verstehen?
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.